Thank you for coming on a weekday. Not easy for working people to do that. Students also. With your permission, please give me your permission. I'm going to continue with a sequence of first canto lecturing that I've been doing. With your permission, we'll cover Canto 1, Chapter 17, that's Punishment and Reward of Kali. And the verses we'll cover are 20, 21, and 22. And they happen to be very profound verses, the subject matter. I'll try to present them in a way that makes it we can appreciate the gravity of Srimad Bhagavatam, the valuable instruction that Bhagavatam is giving. The scene, or the storyline, is Maharaj Parikshit, while ruling over the very prosperous kingdom given to him by Yudhisthira and the Pandavas, is in Hastinapur, and he receives this report that somewhere far away in his kingdom a terrible sin is being committed. The terrible sin is that someone with a club in their hand is breaking the legs of a bull, smashing and smashing and smashing. So simultaneously, Maharaj Parikshit is very unhappy. He's also very happy. He's happy in the sense that as a Kshatriya, now I can use my prowess in religious way. And very unhappy that sinful activity is taking place in his kingdom, because there's no sinful activity in his kingdom. He's such a virtuous king, such a powerful king, and such an effective king. So it just doesn't happen. So he assembles his entire army to go on tour in the direction of where this report has come from. And as he travels from place to place, he spends the evening in some area, some part of his kingdom, where there's a smaller, a lesser king, and the king receives him with great respect and lost his pants there when he walked in the door. Okay, excuse me. Very nice cultural thing. There are bards. Well, there are different kinds of brahmanas, and one of the kind of brahmanas, right? Brahminical culture, we were discussing in the car. The culture was, there are a certain kind of brahmana, their service was to recite not just Puranas, but even, you know, glories of the king and the ancestors of the king. Of course, in Vedic times, the king was a Vedic king. He was connected to lineages of great, great, great kings. And so it was indirectly, it was Krishna Katha, or it was Krishna Katha. So he heard in ecstasy. Tears were streaming from his eyes and his whole body was trembling. He was in ecstasy hearing the glories of the Pandavas, which meant hearing Krishna Katha. So while he was going to do his Kshatriya duty, he was hearing Krishna Katha regularly. And as he reached the place where this very bad deed was being done, he saw the person of very dark complexion, dressed in the robes of a king, with a club in his hand, and smashing and smashing and smashing. So, you know, we would say, caught red-handed. It's not like hearsay. I heard. Is it true? He saw it. He personally observed. So, in Vedic times, there wasn't, you know, this balance of power, the executive head and legislative assembly and the judicial branch of government. It was one person. Because the laws were already made, the laws of Manu, and they ministered according to the laws of Manu. They didn't need a legislative branch. And the king was the judge. He needed to hire judges or elect judges and run up more taxes of the people to pay for all this program. He was powerful. But he held a little fair trial. He asked the cow, or the bull, rather, the bull that was being beaten, "Can you identify the perpetrator?" It's obvious. He's standing there with a club in his hand. "But who is the cause of your suffering?" And there's like eight verses where the bull says, it's very hard to say what's the cause of one's suffering. Some say this, some say that, some say another thing, some say something else altogether. Some say it's karma, some say it's fate, some say it's the stars, some say so many things. People say so many things. "I find it hard to say what's the cause of my suffering." Here, I'll read some of his. Some people say this. "O greatest amongst human beings, it is very difficult to ascertain the particular miscreant who caused our sufferings, because we are bewildered by all the different opinions of theoretical philosophers. Some of the philosophers who deny our assaults of duality declare that one's own self is responsible for his personal happiness and distress." Even Krishna speaks like that. Sada Sadyoni Janmasu, from the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. "Purushak prakriti stohi bhunkte prakriti jan ganan karanam guna sangasya sada sadyoni janmasu." Living entity is responsible for his own happiness and distress. So I'm responsible for my happiness and distress, some people say. Others say that superhuman powers are responsible, while yet others say that activity is responsible. It's one's karma. And the gross materialists maintain that nature is the ultimate cause. Now, text 20. "There are some thinkers who believe that no one can ascertain the cause of distress by argumentation." He gives three. "By argumentation, nor by imagination, nor can it be expressed in words even." Who can say? "But you're a great sage amongst kings. Surely you can say. My dear king, can you say?" So, Prabhupada explains two main things in the purport. That is, the devotee, by nature, a devotee is one who is searching for the absolute truth or is addressing themselves to the absolute truth as the personality of Godhead. And the personality of God is the perfect knower. He's the Paramatma within the heart of every living being. He spends a whole page explaining that. The atheists say you can't convict a person without a fair trial. But Prabhupada is saying, but the Supreme Personality of Godhead certainly knows. And what Dharma, or what the bull is saying to Maharaj Parikshit is, you're intimately related to the Personality of Godhead, and he knows. So you must know, because you're so intimately sharing understandings given directly by him, or receiving understandings given directly by him. So the devotee, knowing this, does not concern themselves so much with the immediate cause of actions or events, whether they're good or bad, because the attention of the devotee is going to the ultimate cause, which goes into the second idea, where Prabhupada says, Vaishnavas agree with this idea. Who can ascertain? And he cites Bhishma Dev. Yes, Bhishma Dev, in the ninth chapter of this first canto. Bhishma Dev speaking to Maharaj Yudhisthira and says, Maharaj Yudhisthira, don't try to understand why all of this happened, because what's very clear is it's the plan of the Lord, and what the intention of the Lord is, nobody understands. The great sages, the demigods, the greatest personalities have been since time immemorial searching out the purpose of the Lord, and they can't. So don't even try. But you can accept that there's a plan of the Lord because you're his devotee. So there are three considerations you should apply in life. This is instruction for us. Three considerations we should apply in our life. One of them is that your actions are according to codes of theistic conduct. You're a religious person. You follow the codes of Scripture. And not just you submit yourself to the codes of Scripture, but how to apply them in your life? Qualified brahmanas and Vaishnavas should be consulted and be submissive to them. And then you could practically just execute something. Lost his pants again. That's your boy, huh?
Yes.
Okay. Get him a belt. He has one on. Okay. Hare Krishna. If you can do religious things and even at least externally follow codes given by brahmanas, but what's your internal purpose or motive? And he says, so the third criterion is that your interest is to please the Personality of Godhead. When these three things are in place, whatever the outcome is, apparently good or apparently bad or mixed, you need not have any lamentation over the outcome. And Maharaj Yudhisthira, you satisfy all three of these criteria. You're the son of Yamaraj. You're Dharmaraj. You're the emblem of virtue. There isn't, outside of theistic conduct, something that's known to you. And before this Kurukshetra battle, you consulted. Even Krishna himself instructed you. He wants you to do this. So you're submissive to the qualified personalities. And you just did what Krishna wanted you to do. That's your life. So outcomes of activities that you engage in, Maharaj Yudhisthira, don't let that be a cause of distress or anxiety for you. It's the plan of the Lord. Just accept it. And now the Lord's plan is, you're the king. So, be the king. Perform your duty. It's a very powerful argument. It gave Yudhisthira relief from this great anxiety he was feeling, and he was able to carry on with his duty. So then he began asking, okay, I'm going to do my duty. Can you tell me how to do my duty? Can you instruct me in the duties of a king and how to understand what the duties of everyone else is, because the king is to see that others are engaged in a prescribed duty? Can you describe the Varnashram system to me and how a king is supposed to be a king so I can do my duty properly? Bhishma Dev's reply was, in ordinary circumstances, one doesn't ask these questions when a man is about to die like this, but because you've asked, I'll reply. And he instructed him thoroughly. So, Prabhupada's comment is, Vaishnavas agree with what the bull is describing. The cause of the outcome of events, whether it's suffering or the other end of the spectrum, happiness. Who can understand? Especially, this applies to us particularly, in the lives of devotees. It's not just, you know, some material cause and effect that brings things about, because Krishna is directly supervising those who are engaged in devotional service. The activity of devotional service is under Krishna's internal potency. To the degree that we're submitting our lives unto Krishna, Krishna takes charge of our lives. And when things go this way, and things all of a sudden start going in that way, like Prabhupada speaks often in this first canto about reversals. It's like, you know, you're going in your car, and all the next thing you know, you're going in the opposite direction. But you didn't put it in reverse. It's just, you're just moving in another direction. What happened? Your life is moving along in a certain expected pattern of things, and all of a sudden you're going in a different direction. I was with just that particular episode, or that phrase. I was living for a while in New England, a regional secretary once upon a time, and the devotees on Sankirtan, they had met a farmer that lived in Maine. So we went to go visit him. And it was in the winter, and he described, he's a dairy farmer. It was a very nice experience. The man received Bhagavad Gita and read it, started chanting, was really excited about, you know, receiving the treasure of Krishna consciousness. So when we visited his home, he knew we were vegetarian and he was okay, and you know, we did the cooking, and we, you know, it was a very nice exchange. So he describes this thing that happened. He said, when you live in a rural situation, people have to take care of each other because they just don't have any other way of support. So there was a heavy, heavy ice and snowstorm, and there was another farmer nearby that got stuck. His tractor got stuck in his field. So I went to go help him. And when I went to go help him, my wife warned me, you know, the roads are really slippery. Watch out. And I said, yes, but I have to, you know, I have to take care of my friend. We have to take care of each other. Otherwise, we can't survive. So he was going along the road, and he came to a bridge, and the thought entered his mind, and then made a little panic feeling in his heart. There's a ravine, and there's a bridge that's going over the ravine, and it's probably frozen ice. So I better slow down. So he push the brake pedal to slow down. But he didn't slow down. He just kept moving in a straight line, pressing the brake, moving the wheel. Nothing happened, just kept moving. And the car that he was riding in was at an angle like this, and the bridge was at a different angle. So he was going, and thinking, this is it. This is the end of my life. It's finished. And he described that as the front end of his... Oh, yeah. Not a small thing. Because he had received the Bhagavad Gita and had begun chanting, he turned to chanting. He just started chanting. It was like... He said, I didn't have to think, it just happened. And as the car was moving over the edge of the bridge, all of a sudden, it snapped and went on the other side of the bridge and stopped. And he thought, God saved my life. Because there's no reason for the car to move like that. It was going over the bridge, into the ravine, and finished. So he said that I could understand there must be, God has some plan. He wants me to do something. I don't know what that something is, but I want to do it, whatever it is. Not just that he saved my life, he wanted me to know that he saved my life and he wanted me to do something. He wants some service from me. So I thought that's a pretty good realization. But it can work the other way too, where it looks like everything's going along great, and then all of a sudden, what happened? It's going not great at all. It's calamity. In the life of a devotee, Prabhupada is describing this, I'm just elaborating, but a devotee understands there's some higher plan of the Lord in all things. So where should our attention go? Should our attention go to the problem? Here's a nice example from the seventh canto, Bhagavatam. It's a Vedic example. The example is of a grass worm that's inside a hole and a bee is coming after him. Bzzz. So what's the attention of the grass worm going to? The bee. And the bee is trying to get in that hole and the grass worm is trying to keep the bee from getting him. And so according to the Bhagavatam verse, by that meditation of the grass worm upon the bee in his next life, what happens? Becomes a bee. Buzz. If we think simply about counteracting the problem, our attention goes to the problem, we get drawn into the material energy by that meditation, contemplation, where the mind goes. Yam yam vapi smarand bhavam chajatante kalevaram. So the devotee needs to be so, not just disciplined, but so faithful that when it's God saves me or God puts me in a reversal, one's attention doesn't go away from the Supreme Being, but somehow there's some plan. The later exam that Maharaj Parikshit had, that is being cursed, doing this very bad thing, and then finding out that he's been cursed to die, he didn't become changed at all. And he accepted there's a plan of the Lord. What that plan is, I don't know. It's something like, because we're going to be observing Ram Navami very soon, Kaikeyi was shocked when she told, Dasarath couldn't say what these two boons were. He was devastated. So Kaikeyi, very boldly, she said, what your father doesn't want to say you can make it come true. He's afraid that he'll break his word of honor. But you can uphold his word of honor because you're Ram. So here's what he wants. He wants that not that you don't become king, but Bharat becomes king. And instead, you go to the forest for 14 years. And Ram's countenance didn't change. There was no disturbance, not even a reaction, other than, is that all, Mother? Why would my father feel so concerned over that? This very day. This is the will of my father. This very day. I'll leave the palace and go to the forest. Is there something else? Or it's something like Maharaj Ambarish, when the fiery demon of Durvas Muni was created by his plucking some hair from his head and dashing it on the ground, chanting or invoking this mantra to create a fiery demon, and pointed Maharaj Ambarish. Kill him. And the fiery demon turned at Maharaj Ambarish and rushed towards him. The Bhagavatam describes the mind and the body of Maharaj Ambarish didn't change. Now imagine, you're a Kshatriya. Something. Now just reflex, even if you're not a Kshatriya. Something comes charging at you. Your arms are going to move. But his arms didn't move, his feet didn't move. His mind didn't move. He just accepted. This is the plan of the Lord. I've made an offense to a great Brahmana. I'm getting my deserve. Just like that. That's a very elevated stage. We're not at that stage. But it teaches us what the life of a Vaishnava should be. Here there's a lesser challenge. Prabhupada's describing it in the purport, where the bull is giving an exam. Maharaj Pariksit was asking the bull, now the bull is asking Maharaj Pariksit, can you say what's the cause of suffering? Because I can't say, I'm bewildered. But you're not bewildered. You're very dear to the Super Soul. You're very dear to Krishna. You must know. So he's taking this challenge. He's got to do his duty as a king. He wants to do his duty as a king. He's very clear what the problem is. But now he's got to solve the problem. And do it justly. You know, it's easy to, you know, he's powerful. Just take his sword and slap the guy into little pieces and it's over. But that's not what a king like Maharaj Pariksit would do. He doesn't simply use his prowess and strength wantonly or indiscriminately. He does it very, very carefully. Justly, very fairly, very appropriately. Prabhupada writes in the purport, the conclusion is, therefore, that the suffering of the representative of religion and the representative of the earth as present before Maharaj Pariksit were planned to prove that Maharaj Pariksit was the ideal executive head because he knew well how to give protection to the cows, the earth, and the brahmanas, religious principles, the two pillars of spiritual advancement. So, what was the cause? Some say it's fate. Some say it's karma. Some say it's destiny. Some say it's the demigods. Some say it's so many things. Maharaj Pariksit's understanding is, the deeper understanding is, Krishna is directly making this arrangement to show the exalted nature of Maharaj Pariksit. He knows just what to do and to do it the right way. So we're not Maharaj Pariksit, but we're also given service to do, and we're given the course of our service. If you haven't noticed, I'm sure you've noticed, but there's challenges. And there's different types of challenges. It's not always the same thing. So what do we do? How do we respond to challenges in our service? If you're, the more that you're Krishna conscious, the more your thought simply goes to the Supreme Lord, and in a prayerful mood, requesting the Supreme Lord for indication, some indication, some direction, some sign, some instruction, something, how to move forward in a way that's going to be pleasing to Him. Because it's very easy, it's too easy just to react. People do it all the time. We have lots of experience of not Krishna conscious people, just something happens and they react. So our to be responsible Vaishnavas, we're getting some nice lessons in the manner of Maharaj Parikshit, how he's handling the situation. So what would you do next? Here's what Maharaj Parikshit does next. The first thing he does is he fixes his mind upon the personality of Godhead. And then he looks upon the bull who's just spoken to him, feeling very satisfied. Here's what Maharaj Parikshit says: "Oh, you who are in the form of a bull, you know the truth of religion, and you are speaking according to the principle that the destination intended for the perpetrator of irreligious acts is also intended for one who identifies the perpetrator. You are no other than the personality of religion." He's citing this principle, or invoking the principle that he's just exhibited. Don't blame the instrument of your own karma. Some of you have heard Peter Burwash speak in New Vrindavan at the Festival of Inspirations. Almost every time he speaks, and he speaks every year, he cites this thing that Prabhupada instructed him. Never, let's say it slowly, never blame the instrument of your own karma. So, fault-finding tendency is very hurtful to the person who's finding fault. It's also hurtful for persons who hear that fault-finding. It's not so harmful for the person who is being faulted. Because what can those words do? And it's something that's being discussed in the purport. The devotee does not busy himself to dismiss fault-finding challenges or the infamy that may come from false accusation. Even Krishna was falsely accused twice. He was accused of murder by Satrajit. When Prasena went into the forest wearing the Shamantaka jewel, and the lion came and attacked him and took the jewel, Satrajit started Krishna did it. Krishna's envious of my jewel. He wanted me to give it to Ugrasena and I didn't. So Krishna killed my brother. Right in Dwarka. Krishna. So what did Krishna do? Did he get all defensive? Or just, you know, strike him down? Satrajit, you're dead. Krishna has the power to do that. You're an offender? To the Supreme Lord, you're finished. That's not what Krishna did. What Krishna did was, he stood by truth. Truth will vindicate my situation. Some of the elders of Dwarka that are respected by everybody, they can come with me and we'll see if we can find the Shamantaka jewel and Prasena. And sure enough, truth prevailed, and when the Shamantaka jewel was given back, so to Trajit, he went into his little private place and started to realize, I'm in big trouble. The whole of Dwarka is going to hate me. I could lose my life for offending Krishna. Then he thought, I better do something to rectify this situation. I'll give the jewel back to Krishna. And I'll give my daughter to Krishna. Krishna said, you keep the jewel. I'll take your daughter. Because he didn't really want to give the jewel. But he was happy to give his daughter. So Krishna accepted Satyabhama as his wife. Anyway, how does a devotee deal with false accusation? In this case, there's not a false accusation. It's Dharma is not willing to be the accuser of another. Even it wasn't false. Because, I'll read how Prabhupada explains this in the purport. It's very delicate, so you have to listen carefully. A devotee's conclusion is that no one is directly responsible for being a benefactor or a mischief monger without the sanction of the Lord. Therefore, he does not consider anyone to be directly responsible for such action. Now, it's not that we're dumb or dull, or there's a man standing with a club and, you know, that act is going on. So it's not, you're wrong to identify this act as being done. But the devotee sees beyond that. What is that? This is this person that's doing this act, good or bad, is an instrument. So we don't give praise or blame to the instrument. But in both cases, the devotee takes it for granted that either benefit or loss is God-sent, and thus it is his grace. Any details? In the case of benefit, no one will deny that it is God-sent, but when in the case of reverses, one becomes doubtful. But how the Lord could be so unkind to his devotee to put him into great difficulty? Haven't we heard this so many times? Somebody has a health problem, or somebody has a financial problem, or somebody has a something problem, an accident. How can, you know, they're such a nice devotee, how can that happen? Why did God let this happen? That kind of talk goes on. So is somehow God sent? That is the way of accepting a thing. Either favorable or unfavorable. Thus, for a devotee, the identifier is equally a sinner like the mischief monger. That is, again, we can recognize if someone's doing something bad. We're not unable to identify someone has done something bad. But our consciousness doesn't just go to that cause-effect. There's Krishna, ultimately. Somebody asked me this just... it's so common. Just on Sunday. It was after a wedding in Chicago. And the wedding was the previous day. Then on Sunday, the family members came. We sat together for a bit, and the sister of one who was married, right in front of everybody, was saying, you know, how do we deal with situations where, you know, people are just mean? How can you not hold ill will towards them because they're being really mean. You know, it's like the implicit in the question was, I know I shouldn't feel ill will towards them. But how do you not feel ill will towards somebody when they're being downright mean? How do you do it? So you have to see beyond the cause-effect. One example I gave was there's this saying, a Christian saying, you may hate the sin but not the sinner. You see the soul. Here's a soul that's suffering so badly. They're acting with anger or malice or hurtfulness because they're suffering. That poor soul is suffering. So instead of feeling ill will towards the person, feel compassion towards the person. But that's a nice idea that's not going to sustain without seeing the soul. And ultimately, the sanction of God, because you could feel bad towards God. God, why is God letting this person suffer so much? They do all these hurtful things to other people. He doesn't want that people suffer or that they do hurtful things. He has compassion too. So it's to be fixed in Krishna consciousness, like Maharaj Pariksit is fixed in Krishna consciousness. It's not a mental adjustment. Oh, that's a nice way to think. I'll try that for a while. That mental adjustment doesn't work. One has to come to the soul platform. And to come to the soul platform and stay there, one has to come to the Krishna platform or Krishna conscious platform. And then there are signs or symptoms of a Krishna conscious person, like Maharaj Pariksit. So one of them is this one, being unmoved through the various deeds that are done that sometimes are pleasure producing and sometimes are suffering producing, and being equal in both, literally being unchanged in both. It's possible. It's what we're supposed to be doing, and we can come to that platform through this very nice process of Bhagavat Dharma, hearing very and appreciating very deeply the qualities of Krishna and the qualities of Krishna's pure devotees. And by hearing, just like the grass worm meditating upon the bee from earlier in this discussion, by meditating upon the personality of Godhead and these wonderful devotees who are unchanged through all kinds of reversals, that quality becomes our quality. That's how devotees develop qualities, by meditating upon those who have qualities and glorifying those who have such exalted qualities and hearing about them, remembering them, chanting, praying to them, absorbing our consciousness in these transcendental personalities. This is Bhagavad Dharma. Concluding statement, Prabhupada writes, in other words, a devotee has no suffering at all, because so-called suffering is also God's grace for a devotee who sees God in everything. Well, that was easy. Easy to read, and then it's challenging to do. But that's the standard of Krishna consciousness. So, just after speaking this kind of appreciation to the bull, saying, I can understand, you're not just a bull, you're not just a philosopher, you're Dharma himself. No one can speak, no one can be so poised as you. Just as Dharma is appreciating the quality of Maharaj Pariksit. And then he turns to address the situation. He addresses the personality of Kali. with his sword raised, ready to do what he has to do. And the rest unfolds. Okay, so I'll end with that and see if there's any comments or questions from anyone. Yes. Oh.
As you we understand, is that without Krishna and the devotee should stay firm on the devotion of Krishna. But sometimes, should we try to change the situation, help the person, try to turn the situation, not just leaving, okay, it's without Krishna, and just walk away from there?
No. We shouldn't just walk away from there. But the first step is to think of Krishna. And when you think of Krishna, think, Krishna has put me in this situation. How can I best serve him? What would be an appropriate service to Krishna in this circumstance? How, or the other individual? How can I serve the other individual to help them come to Krishna consciousness? Let's take, there's so many examples, but one is Narada confronting Nalakuvir and Madigriva. And what they did was insulting. They were so intoxicated, they didn't know it was insulting, but it was insulting. But Narada didn't get insulted. His thought went to, what can be done to help these two very embarrassed personalities? What would be the best thing to help them? And he goes into, you know, we go through the thoughts, the inner thoughts and contemplations of Narada Muni, how to best help them. So, like that, in each encounter, going back to an earlier statement, it's easy to react. People do it all the time. And we tend to do it too. But if the position that we go to is contemplating our position of service to Krishna, and in the mood of service to Krishna, what's appropriate in this circumstance for pleasing Krishna? And then do that in the mood of service. My Krishna, he didn't just walk away in Dwarka, oh, they're just talking. Nor did he go and chop down Satrajit. He decided it would be harmful for people to continue to speak this way, best if that was cleared. And the way to clear it is, let others clear it. I'll go with them and they'll see and they'll report to everybody. And that's what happened. They went back and reported. Krishna didn't steal the jewel. Prasena was killed by a lion. And Krishna went to retrieve the Shyamataka jewel. It hasn't come out. So many days we waited. But their report cleared Krishna's name. He didn't have to do anything. But, you know, personally. But as appropriate. And each situation of life is different, so each solution is, or how we address ourselves is different. The way that we can serve should be appropriate for the circumstance. And how do we get that indication unless we're Krishna conscious? Krishna will guide us. Anything else? Yes.
What was the second accusation towards Krishna?
About the witch?
He said that Krishna accused twice.
Oh, the second accusation. After he was accused of causing famine and like lack of rainfall, drought, and famine and disease to come to Dwarka. The reason was because Akrura had left Dwarka. And it was understood that Swapalka, the father of Akrura, was known as being the kind of person where wherever he was, that drought would disappear. And so Akrura was understood to have the quality like his father, Swapalka. So when Akrura left Dwarka, drought and a shortage of food in Dwarka, in Krishna's presence, how is that? It's Krishna's arrangement. That's how it was. So people were... Krishna caused Akrura to leave. Whereas Krishna knew it was the absence of the Shyamataka jewel. Actually, it was his own arrangement. So he called for Akrura to come back and said, Akrura, I hear that you're worshipping at a golden altar. Where'd you get all that gold, Akrura? Do you have the Shyamataka jewel? May I see it? Oh, I just happen to have it with me. Very nice. I just want to show it to everyone so they know that was the reason. And I'll give the Shyamataka jewel back to you. I don't want it. You keep it. So he was being falsely accused. The particular action was different, but the principle that he applied was the same. He stood by truth, and truth cleared his name. Let truth speak. That's commonly a very good principle to live by. Don't become disturbed. Truth will prevail. And just always abide with truth. Never depart from truth. And truth will protect you, just like you protect Dharma, Dharma will protect you. Yes?
I want to add two follow-up questions. One was in terms of reacting to adverse circumstances. And the work situation, oftentimes, it's almost part of the job description that you're expected to react, and if you're not, then...
You're docile. And people will take advantage of you.
Right, and also, you know, the other people think you're not being a Shastra, because if you're representing a group of people and they, you know, they think that you're not doing a good job of representing them, and how do we bring this into practice in those situations?
In those situations, same thing. Same thing. First thought goes to Krishna. Krishna, I'm your devotee. I'm in this place not to serve those people, but to serve you. You've put me here. What is appropriate service for you in this circumstance? So then the mood is not reaction. The mood is service. So you may take, you know, a mild, you may take a strong, you may be neutral, but it's in the mood of service, not reactive and not passive. Even in the workplace. I've been reading Ramayana lately because in anticipation of Ram Navami. There's a very nice section where what to speak of in the workplace, where Ram is saying no to Vashishta, and one of the ministers of the royal palace and Bharat, and they're giving, you know, strong arguments. Vashishta says, your nature is you just want to serve others. And here's your brother who is dearer to you than life itself, and he's at your feet begging for you to come back. And you upheld the word of your father, You went to the forest. You've already demonstrated obedience to your father's will. Now, in the absence of your father, he's being asked to be the king, and he's asking you to come back. It's like very compelling arguments. And he says no. So what to speak of the workplace? You know, he speaks another principle that's higher than those principles that were mentioned. And he even chastises the minister, a Brahmin. My dear Brahmin, the words you are speaking are untruthful. How do you make your way into the court of King Dasarath when you speak untruth? Heavy. But not other than in this mood of service, as appropriate. So the appropriate part is very subtle, but if one can be in the proper mood of service, the subtle comes easier than just trying to like figure it out, kind of, what's appropriate. The mental platform is not strong like the spiritual platform is strong. And the spiritual platform is a platform from which we can always act because it's who we are. In any circumstance, we can act from the spiritual platform. If we're on the spiritual platform, if we're acting from the platform of the soul. Our business is not just to get the other people in the office to think we're doing our job well. Our business is to please Krishna and do your job well for Krishna. And that's stronger. If somebody says you're not doing your job properly, you know, in the right mood of service to Krishna, act from the soul and say it otherwise. And if you're not doing your job properly, then own up to it. Anything else? You had a second? You said two-part thing?
In terms of the pastime of Vaishnavaraj and Dharma in the form of Guru personified, I was just wondering that he starts the conversation by saying, what's the cause of your distress? And then Dharma replied that it's not very easily ascertainable by me what's the actual cause of distress. And I guess I was just visualizing the picture that there's Kali and he's, you know, he's actually meeting the bull with a club.
Yeah.
And so isn't it obvious that that's the cause of it?
Yes. He's not saying that that's not happening and I'm so out of it I can't figure that out. But the question wasn't, is this man with the club hitting you on the leg? That wasn't the question. The question was, what's the cause of suffering? What's the cause? Why is this man standing there doing it? Is, in other words, I can't say. He took it like that in any case. The direct is clear. The remote is less clear. The remote is the cause of the direct. So a philosophical bowl. But he's Dharma. And he's wanting to avoid... There's other philosophical... The next thing that comes out philosophically is that everything is going on by Krishna's energy. So we can say Krishna's energy is doing it. And Krishna's energy is moving all of us. At the same time, Krishna's doing nothing. Although his energies are doing everything. Like Krishna says, so many things I've created, but actually that I'm doing nothing at all. It's deep. It's deep. The same thing, the same discussion. This is chapter 17. The same discussion comes up in chapter 18. The same discussion. Different context. The Bhagavatam wants us, the Bhagavad Gita wants us to understand we're not this body. And then, if the understanding we're not this body, how to act in the world in that consciousness with detached work, with devotion, is how you do detached work. Then the Bhagavatam takes it into further levels of apparent complexity as real life gets complex, and how to stay in that consciousness. How does one who is in that consciousness think? It's giving us like a roadmap, or at least examples. Because otherwise, we're all trying, to be nice devotees, but circumstances of life are very challenging, and we find that we're not being very Krishna conscious in some circumstances of life. So how do we best do that? The Bhagavatam is giving us the nice instruction. So that we can always be Krishna conscious, even in the complexities of life. That if we read the Bhagavatam in that way, that's what's going on. It's not just, it's a nice discussion about Dharma, Maharaj Parikshit, he's on tour with his military, and the storyline is nice. It's attractive to the mind. But embedded in that is some very, very powerful instructions that are very practical in our lives. We're not on tour with our army. We're doing something else. But the instructions are embedded within the Bhagavatam, if we read it properly. Okay. Thank you very much. The Prabhupada Ki Jai.